Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome back to Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Bird-Wilt.
And we're happy to be back with you, all three of us here again, to talk about Obi-Wan Kenobi on Disney+. We've had a chance to watch the second half of the series, think about it all together, and we'd like to share our thoughts with you, including whether certain things that we talked about for our previous Obi-Wan episode panned out or went in completely different directions. Let's start, as we always do, with the main character, Obi-Wan, and what we saw in the back half of the season here. We talked about this a little bit in our first episode, but I like to see, you know, he starts off as somebody who hasn't used the Force in a while, and you see the progression of his Force abilities. You see more of that in the second half of the season, and I think it shows. It's not just about, like, oh, he's doing more cool stuff with the Force. I think for me what it's emblematic of is he's getting more in touch with his old self. He's rediscovering, you know, the Obi-Wan Kenobi that has been hiding behind the Ben Kenobi of it all. And, you know, by the end, of course, with that climactic duel with Vader, he's able to do some stuff that, you know, we've certainly never seen Obi-Wan do before. And we really haven't seen a ton of Jedi overall do in terms of just throwing that giant pile of rocks at Vader in a way that is completely, you know, polar opposite from what we see with him in the Force in the first episode of the season. Do either of you have thoughts about what we see as far as the progression of Obi-Wan getting back in touch with that side of him that, you know, again, we kind of last saw in Revenge of the Sith?
I liked it. I thought that it was a very natural progression that they had built up over the six episodes, and that did feel earned to me. I liked how they had established in previous episodes that he was really struggling in the Force, struggling to connect on a spiritual, mental, physical level, and that by the end of the show, he really had his groove back. And I think it was good to see that part of that was just from practice, that he has been out of it for 10 years, and part of this is just the body and the mind relearning that, oh yeah, this is how I'm a Jedi. But I really, really liked that most of his strength, his well of strength that he derived by the end of the last episode came from his love for Luke and Leia, and by extension, his love for Anakin as well, his friend whom he now sees as lost, but who lives on in these two children that he loves and wants to protect. So I thought it was a very natural progression. It felt right to me.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed out this idea of he has specifically, and I put this in my notes, you know, he is taken on the task of protecting Luke, but by the time that scene comes about, the one you're talking about, where he draws that strength and is able to escape the tomb that Vader has built for him, it's also really very much about Leia, as you said. And I think, you know, and not to sort of put too fine a point on it, but he didn't really think too much about Leia before, you know, the beginning of this series. He was very much focused on Luke, and I think you see here him coming to terms with the fact that, yeah, Anakin's legacy is actually two children. You know, he's taken on the mission to protect one of them, but he's now had experience protecting the other one as well. And he sees Anakin's legacy in its more in its fullest form, if you will. You know, other things that I thought were really cool in this episode about Obi-Wan were, I really like seeing how kind of the regular people of the galaxy relate to a Jedi, and specifically to a Jedi as renowned as Obi-Wan. And I love the scene in, I think it was the last episode, where he is saying, basically, I'm going to take the escape pod and draw Vader away, and all of you have done so much for me, you've done so much for the Jedi, it's time for me to do something for you, which, you know, these people have set out to protect the Jedi Order. I don't think any of them went into it with the expectation that they would ever be repaid for that. But I like seeing Obi-Wan, you know, again, more have more of a recognition of the fact that it's not just about the Jedi themselves. It's about that whole support system. It's about all the people who stand behind them, who stand for the light, you know, thinking sort of about the image at the end of The Last Jedi, where it's the, you know, the broom boy, really emblematic of all the people who reach for the light, who stand for the light, even if they're not Jedi themselves. And I just liked that scene as a way of paying off, you know, Obi-Wan has been very single-minded about this quest with Vader, you know, protecting Leia, but he stops and really thinks about the fact that there is this whole network of people who are trying to fight for the same thing he is, and he ultimately takes what he perceives to be this massive risk. Of course, we know he survives, but he's willing to take this huge risk to protect them. Obviously, Leia's on the ship as well, but he could have just gotten away with her somehow. It wasn't just about Leia. I thought that was a really beautiful way of connecting him to this larger movement that he has sort of been adjacent to, but he hasn't really, you know, we haven't really seen him dwell on it very much.
I like that too, Eric. And I think one part I like about that is it's not just like one layer, it's very multi-layered. Because I think, if I'm remembering correctly, there's sort of a moment where he's telling this to them and they're like, no, that's dumb, like we're trying to save you. And then sort of the head guy is like, you're doing this because it's about Darth Vader, like Anakin also. And Obi-Wan sort of, he doesn't really reject that. Am I remembering that correctly? I think so.
That's yeah, I before... think you're remembering yeah. that correctly. Yeah.
I don't know. I liked that part of it too. It just, it seemed sort of authentic in a way.
Yeah, the way that head guy, whose name I don't remember, but who is, I think, played by O'Shea Jackson
Roken,
Jr.
I think.
Roken. I remember actors' names more often than characters' name. But I think that conversation also kind of shows how Obi-Wan is almost as single-minded in his focus on Vader as Vader is on his focus on Obi-Wan, respectively. But unlike Vader, Obi-Wan is able to see and connect with the people around him, recognize that there is a larger movement than him and his own issues and trauma. And I think that conversation with Roken highlighted that. His conversation with Indira Varma's character.
Oh, it's in my notes.
The actress again.
Tala.
Tala. Tala. She was great. I liked her a lot. And having Tala sacrifice herself for the rebellion, resistance, whatever you call it in this nascent form, and having that moment of eye contact with Obi-Wan and having Obi-Wan realize that there is more to the universe, the galaxy, than his mission and his grief. I think all of that was very nicely done.
Well, you know, you did just compare and contrast Obi-Wan and Vader there. I think we have to talk about, you know, the Vader of the second half of the series. But let me start with not quite Vader, Anakin. We got some really great, wonderful, beautiful flashbacks to pre-Attack of the Clones, Obi-Wan and Anakin. In a lot of ways, this is one of those things that I think we never really thought we would see. I didn't expect there would be this much, that they would go this far back. I mean, we certainly talked about flashbacks. I think we had anticipated that they would be Clone Wars era flashbacks. This takes us back pretty far. I personally thought it worked really well. I know some people were critical of Hayden Christensen looking like he does today, not looking like the Hayden of Attack of the Clones, which was, 20 years ago. They filmed it, you know, 21, 22 years ago or whatever. I think it looked great. I was really happy with it. And of course, that duel that they have in the Jedi Temple, it's this great metaphor for, again, the comparison that you just made between Obi-Wan and Anakin, and Anakin's shortcomings and his fixation on certain aspects of a conflict and how that blinds him to certain other things. What did you two think of those flashbacks?
It was so well edited just in the broader writing of that episode. It's been a while since I watched it, so I won't go much further than that. I just remember being impressed by how they, like, at just the timing of it and the pacing. I feel like they did a really good job. And I agree with you, Eric. I was not bothered by the how they didn't de-age him so much that it looked, I don't know, like the aged Luke.
Yeah.
No, I liked it better this way too.
I also really thought it was well edited, well done. The fight choreography was really fun, and nice callback to their Battle of the Heroes lightsaber flourishes, but also telling an important story within the episode, the larger narrative. So narratively, I really liked it. And I totally agree on the de-aging front. As both of you and listeners know, I am not a fan of the Uncanny Valley de-aging. I super hate the de-aged Luke of Book of Boba Fett, although I was okay with it in Mandalorian season 2. But that's neither here nor there. I was very happy that Anakin was not de-aged. And I even read some analysis on Reddit too that I thought was kind of interesting, which is that with the having him look like, you know, 40-year-old Hayden Christensen instead of 20-year-old Hayden Christensen, that does have the side benefit of showing viewers what Anakin would have looked like had he not fallen to the dark side. So in showing him like at the real age that he is, there's this kind of alternate universe echo to it, which I thought was just an interesting analysis of it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but it does give us a little glimpse of the road not taken. But of course, that road is not taken, and Anakin very, you know, tragically becomes this hulking monster in the suit of armor. And in the last episode, we get a reunion between Anakin and Obi-Wan, and they have this, what I thought was a really incredible duel on this planet, whose name I've forgotten. I will say, you know, calling, you know, back to, I think in our first episode, I made it pretty clear I was not a huge fan of the fact that they were going to have these duels that would, in my opinion, change the what George Lucas very clearly intended to be the meaning of that line in A New Hope. It happened. There's nothing I can do about it. So I've made my peace with it. But again, as with that first duel, and I said this in our previous Obi-Wan episode, if it had to happen, I think it was handled in a really good way. I think it was done impressively from a technical, you know, choreography standpoint. I also think the emotional resonance of the duel, the different beats that we see and why they actually matter for these characters, were also done really well. I had put in my notes that the Vader that we see in this second duel is, first of all, very different from the Vader of that first duel, where it's not really much of a duel. He's kind of reserved and withdrawn in a sense. This is very different. This is, you know, Vader unleashed. This is Vader, you know, he's like an animal. I mean, he yells. We don't see that a lot. It's notable that when we do see that, they're basically putting an exclamation point on the emotion and the intensity of the moment. I mean, when you think about, you know, when he yells at the stormtroopers on the Tantive IV, you know, tear this ship apart and, you know, bring me the passengers. I want them alive. I mean, that's one of his first lines. He yells that line, and then we almost never hear him yell again, which indicates when he's feeling particularly strongly about something, when there's urgency. We see a lot of that here. We see him really go overboard when he thinks he's killed Obi-Wan. He buries him in these rocks, and he just keeps piling on the rocks. I thought, you know, far longer than seemed necessary. But the point is, of course, that he has this compulsion to just destroy Obi-Wan utterly. Part of him realizes that he has probably already accomplished the job, but, you know, the overkill is the point in that scene. He has to be totally sure. And even after that point, there's a part of him that just can't stop himself from, he's got to keep going. And that was very deliberate in showing his fixation and his irrepressible fury. And I just thought, man, that was just really well done.
Also, that duel was just so good.
It was.
And Obi-Wan with the rocks flying at him is just, it was beautiful. I realize this is not particularly creative commentary from me, but I just have to mention it.
Well, sometimes all you can do is admire beauty, and there was quite a lot of beauty in that scene. Of course, it ends, or I guess we should say part of it, you know, part of that fight ends with a scene that Star Wars Rebels fans are very familiar with because it happened almost beat for beat in the same way, just with a different character, Ahsoka, instead of Obi-Wan. We see Obi-Wan damage Vader's mask in a conveniently perfect way so that it only cuts off just enough to give us this very darkly artistic, you know, view of, you know, half mask, half man. And we do see Anakin under there. First time we've seen Hayden in live action, you know, under the helmet, or I guess I should say the Hayden version of Anakin, because again, we saw this in Rebels. This is the first time in live action. What did you think of how they handled that scene? I thought it was a really beautiful moment.
So I think it worked. I mean, as I was watching it, I did have to acknowledge, like, this is basically cribbed entirely from Rebels, which, I mean, they're making the calculation that probably a lot of people watching this show haven't watched Rebels, which is probably true. And it's a really freaking great idea. So I'm I'm casting no stones noting how much it seemed to be pretty kind of cribbed from Rebels. But I did think that was interesting. But it worked because it was so emotionally affecting, particularly to have Hayden and Ewan doing these characters again, connecting in a way that we haven't seen them since, you know, the lava beach of Mustafar. It was very powerful. And speaking from an artistic standpoint, that beauty that Haley mentioned, I really loved when their face was highlighted by the glow of lightsabers.
Oh, so good.
Right? And at times it seemed like Vader's face was highlighted by the blue glow. And then as he said the lines about, you didn't kill Anakin Skywalker, I did, then it shifts to the red glow on his face.
What a great line.
Yeah, great line. Great.
I mean, it's a little
visual there. Exactly.
But that's who he is, Haley. That's who he is.
So I do have to point out while we're here in this point of the conversation, this is not an original thought. I read this on Twitter when I, like, accidentally happened across spoilers when, like, the Star Wars Hive was all reacting to that episode. I think it was supposed to... It wasn't, like, cribbing it from Rebels. They, if you look at the, like... It's both different sides of his face that they managed to get off. The helmet that they managed to, like, slice off. The people of the internet have said that, like, oh, it's very poetic that both Ahsoka and Obi-Wan were, like, able to do half of the job, but, like, only Luke was the one who was able to fully remove the helmet and all this stuff. So I feel like there's more meaning to it than just, like, that's, you know, an interesting visual that we could use. And what lends credence to that is that it was two different sides of the helmet. I don't know. I found it valid.
I had noticed that it was two different sides of the helmet, so I do really like that analysis, Haley. That is a good thing to mention.
It comes from Twitter. All credit to the people of Twitter who were posting the screenshots.
I think it's just interesting that, like, Vader, again, he's somebody we very rarely see anybody best him, and so there's a certain narrative power in just seeing him weak. You know, not only the labored breathing, which of course connects to both Rebels and Return of the Jedi, but also just the damage to the suit. I mean, I think we've all thought when we were watching Darth Vader fight anybody, like, that chest plate is a pretty obvious target for, like, a sniper shot or, like, something. Like, it's literally keeping him alive. Like, how has nobody done more with the fact that he really has a giant vulnerability, literally a target in the center of his chest, and here we see Obi-Wan finally get some use out of it. Another thing that I noticed at the end of the duel, after Obi-Wan has beaten Vader, he's walking away. He's basically done. I mean, I don't know if he thinks he's killed Vader or if he just thinks that he's taken him off the board, but Vader just can't give up, and he keeps shouting Obi-Wan's name. And I interpreted that as like, okay, like, maybe you've won, but, like, kill me. Like, make this official. Like, don't just walk away from me. Like, I want the sort of the closure, right, of having this be done between us.
It's like the idea of mercy is just reprehensible to him.
Yeah, well, because it's also it's mercy, but it's also just like a lack of like committing to their personal animosity toward each other. Like,
also, Obi-Wan is responsible for the death of like billions of people, if you take this logic, because he could have saved Alderaan, and he just walked away. Anyway, I guess that's extrapolation, because like the Death Star project was already like underway, and you know, someone else could have carried that out.
I mean, but if you still go really far back, you know, Watto was responsible for the destruction of Alderaan. <Right. laughs> Yes, I think there's an obsessiveness in this scene from Vader, which again, I'll keep hammering this home. We just don't see that kind of Vader a lot, where he's the Anakin type of Vader, where it's like there is just this blind obsessiveness. It's this sort of primal thing. It short circuits all of his common sense, all of his discipline, his composure. It's just like, we're not done here, right? Come back here. Don't walk away from me. It's that kind of energy. And I just think it fits well here. It makes sense here. And it's really cool to see. So props to them for doing that.
I think, too, it echoes that line that he has. I think it's the third episode where Vader says, "You should have killed me when you had the chance." I think it shows that there's this part of Vader/Anakin who wishes that Obi-Wan had killed him, and who is angry and frustrated that, again, he has not been killed, that Obi-Wan has left him again to suffer. And like Haley said, that is mercy in a sense, but it also isn't.
It's cruelty.
Right. And the other thing that I really want to talk about this particular duel was, I really loved how at the end Obi-Wan says something like, "Goodbye, Darth." And I think it was such a neat way to connect it to A New Hope, because in A New Hope, when Darth Vader says, "Now I am the master," then Obi-Wan says, "Only a master of evil, Darth." And it has always felt kind of false. Like, why would he use the title Darth instead of calling him Vader? And obviously the reason is that he wasn't really known as Vader yet in 1977. But from a narrative in-universe perspective, it just always rang a really false note to me. So it made a lot of sense now to have it in this show, where when he says Darth, it's because he's accepting that Anakin is really gone. And he uses the term dismissively. It's kind of, it's honestly a pretty sick burn.
It's like mockery.
It's a mockery.
It's like, oh, you think you're, like, it's mocking the idea that being a Darth something is a position of power. It's like, there's almost like a, you know how like people on Twitter will like do that thing with the text where it's like they capitalize every other letter?
Yes.
So that's kind of how I interpret him using the word Darth. It's like, oh, Darth, like, yeah, you're big shot over here.
Yeah, I loved that. I thought that was a great little retcon of that line in A New Hope, to bring it to that emotional level of, my friend is dead. If you are what remains, then you're not even truly worth my time, my attention, my care, my desire to kill you. Yeah, like, sure, okay, bye, Darth. It was just a great little character moment and a great roast, too.
Yeah, there's another layer, too. I noticed that in the script for, and it's in the final movie, too, in Empire Strikes Back, Obi-Wan, the ghost of Obi-Wan, does call him Vader to Luke when he says, you know, if you choose to face Vader, you will face him alone. And I think I read this as, when he interacts with him directly, he does use that mocking, condescending term to his face. But in other contexts, he's more sort of straightforward, like, this is Vader. Like, I'm going to call him Vader because that's ultimately who he is. But he doesn't give Vader the satisfaction of using that sort of terrifying name to his face.
Exactly.
You know, you did mention the line, Anakin's gone, I'm what remains, which, as Haley pointed out, very emo stuff here, but also very much in keeping with who Vader is at this point. And it does connect to what you said before about that sense of he's not really happy with who he is. And a part of him does wish that Obi-Wan would have just finished the job. I mean, if you describe yourself as the remains of someone else, that is not a self-affirming way of seeing yourself. Right, that does not suggest that you have a lot of pride in who you are, in what you are. I mean, I could just be reading too much into the word choice here, but I saw that as a reflection of the fact that deep down, he's basically going through the motions with his job as the enforcer for the Emperor. It's all he has left. It's not something that he's particularly proud of.
The only last thing I want to note about that duel in this scene is that when he piles all the rocks on Obi-Wan, he has the high ground.
That's true. The shoe is on the other foot now.
I thought he was going to say something about it, y'all. Because it was like a lingering shot enough that, like, there was a moment where I was like, he's going to be like, oh, I have the high ground. I'm glad he didn't.
Maybe,
anyway.
Like, there's a deleted scene where he did that. Although that would have been in keeping with the Darth Vader of Rogue One, where he makes the pun about choking. Would have been, I think, a little bit more in character with that, which I still, as much as I'm a fan of puns, that was a little bit much for me, that scene. Okay, I think let's talk about what could end up being our biggest disagreement of the Obi-Wan Kenobi series, depending on where this goes. I don't know, maybe you agree with me on this, but I am not sold on the twist with Reva. I don't like it. It doesn't work for me. It's not a compelling narrative for me. So we find out that she was, in fact, as a lot of people had suggested, one of the Padawans. I don't know if technically in that scene at the beginning, but certainly she was a Jedi Padawan. She was almost killed. She hid among the bodies, which, you know, feels pretty real these days, unfortunately, and they did have a warning about that on Disney Plus. She survived and she becomes an Inquisitor. But from there, I'm like, okay, so why, and to, like, when were you going to act on this? She was hunting Vader. She was going to kill Vader out of revenge.
How many innocent people are you going to kill you get vengeance on a murderer?
Obviously, yes, that's one part of it. Is even if, like, her plan, like, was internally logical and she was acting in a believable way, I would still say it's not justified. But let's even put that aside. Let's put aside the fact that she kills all these innocent people as part of her quest. What is the time frame she's working with for her quest? Like, she's presumably been around Darth Vader for months, if not years. When was she planning to kill him? What was she waiting for? And then in the last episode, she very dramatically goes after Luke, which is a pretty, like, bold thing for Star Wars to do, is put Luke in this danger that it's not the Tusken Raiders, as you know, Owen and Beru say. It's very much he's coming face to face with the dark side here, so that was pretty significant. But then she backs off because she realizes that she sees herself as Vader and Luke was her, and it's like, you're just realizing that now? Like, you're just figuring out that you're the Vader in this situation, and you're just being repulsed enough by that thought to stop, to back down? Like, how... You wanted revenge for your friends, so you're going to do the same thing that your friends went through. Like, how did that... I understand that you can hand wave it away and say she's, you know, been traumatized. She's been through unimaginable grief. The brain does strange things. You're not always behaving logically. But we've seen her... She's a pretty cool cucumber, right? She's not somebody who is deranged by grief at all times, right? She has flashbacks to the moment of her suffering, but she's not constantly consumed by it in the way that you could imagine somebody being completely out of their mind, right? I mean, she presumably has been, you know, mentally competent enough to realize what she's doing, and yet it never occurs to her that, like, what she's doing is not actually serving the people that she's ostensibly trying to serve. And it's not a heat of the moment thing either. Like, it's a long-term proposition that she somehow only finds out at this moment when we happen to see it on screen. oh, turns out what I'm doing makes absolutely no sense. Am I the only one who is like, how did you get this into your head that this would be the thing to do?
No, you're correct. I agree a lot. Grace, I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I agree too. I think, honestly, my biggest disappointment of the show was ultimately how they handled her character. Because I had a lot of high hopes for her character. I do think that Moses Ingram acted the heck out of it, even yes. and especially when it made no sense. like she was 110% committed, and even if I didn't buy the character beats and development or reasoning, I always bought her as the character, if that makes sense.
It does, yes.
Can I say, so sort of unrelatedly, but on the same topic, I was disappointed that upon learning her backstory, Obi-Wan is like, okay, time to manipulate and like use her and like put her in the line of death. And I'm like, I understand he had a lot going on and he was like saving other people's lives, but I felt like it wasn't very kind.
I mean, she put herself in the line of death. Like,
this is true.
She signed up for that and a whole lot more.
But he also made it seem like he was going to, like, help her.
Yeah.
Like, they would have taken Darth Vader on together. But that wasn't what happened.
He knew how outmatched she was. I think the second best duel of the series was Darth Vader's duel with Reba, if it can even be called a duel, because it was basically him just owning her for several minutes without even lifting a finger, literally just using the force. And it was so cool, so well done, really hammered home Vader's power and his malice. And I thought that was a great duel just from a visual perspective. But that also led to one of the other issues I had with this story, which was, so you've known all along that she was going to do this and you just went with it and you knew she was the Padawan and you were like, you had no backup plans. You were
That sure. worked perfectly for me. Like, I mean, because think about it. She's a good tool. She's effective at what she does. So, like, why would you take that tool off the board before you absolutely had to? Like, you know, she's not a threat to you. So when she finally makes her move, you can easily, you don't have to worry about your life. And until then, she's decided for whatever reason, which we all agree is pretty stupid, that she's going to be an Inquisitor. So let her be an Inquisitor. Like, I guess I didn't see that as creating any risk for him.
I suppose that's true. It just... It felt like a bit Deus Ex Machina-ish to me that, I mean, I know that Vader is super powerful and especially contrasted to then when we see him with Obi-Wan, it really, you know, hammers home how powerful he is against Awen normal compared to how, you know, unbalanced and unmoored he becomes around Obi-Wan. So I understand that. But it just also felt a bit like, so Vader's omnipotent now. He remembers the face of a 12-year-old he tried to kill 20 years or 10 years ago.
And like, there must have been so many of them. That's the thing. Like,
yeah,
there were a lot of 12-year-olds, unfortunately, sadly.
But no, I agree, Eric. I was ultimately disappointed by that plotline, which was frustrating because I thought that character had a lot of promise, but ultimately I think that was probably the weakest link of the series in terms of storytelling, was how they handled her character. But again, want to reiterate that I think Moses Ingram did a really, really good job with the character, and any error there is not due to her acting.
Yeah, she was not well served, but I completely agree with you that she inhabited that character so well. And again, up until that twist, I had really no complaints about her character. She was well acted throughout the whole thing, and I think that's a you know, they did Moses Ingram dirty, and it certainly is not the first time that they have done that to a woman of color in Star Wars, and I think that bears repeating as well. I feel bad because she's, you know, we don't know what comes next for her, but I don't get the sense that they're going to do anything more with her. And she's, you know, Moses Ingram seems like a great person, a really fun person, somebody who had a lot of fun doing this and who is just, you know, someone great to have in Star Wars. Which reminds me, I don't know if you saw this, but somebody found a clip of her in costume. I don't know, I would love to know where this is from, but they posted it on Twitter and it's her with the lightsaber and she spins it around and she says, "I'm Moses Ingram and you're watching Disney Channel." And I just thought, like, oh, it was so amazing. Precious. I'll have to find it. Maybe we can put the link in the show notes. But, like, she's having fun. And, you know, frankly, for somebody who, you know, seemed as on board with all this Star Wars stuff as she was, knowing, you know, presumably knowing what it was going to entail, unfortunately, having seen, you know, the experiences of people who came before her, she was not well treated by the writers of by the writer of the show, Joby Harold. Unfortunately, did not get the characterization that I think she deserved. And yeah, just to kind of close that out, I will also agree with you on the duel. It was just a great depiction of Vader as somebody who's in control. She's like a gnat to him. Like, she's not even a combatant. Like, he'll just swat her away, and it's not even particularly. There's like not a lot of cruelty in that duel. It's more just like, we both know how this is going to go, and like, I'm just taking this to its logical conclusion. I'm dealing with you the way I put down anybody who defies me, and you're not a threat to me, and I'm just going to kind of dispassionately deal with you. Although at the end, you know, he does sort of remind her of the fact that they've been here before, and so there is a twinge of like, you get the sense that he does take some pleasure in it at that point. But up until then, it's kind of just the classic Vader that we all know and love.
I have a totally unrelated topic I wish to discuss before we move on to some of the other things.
Yes, please. Show notes.
So the more I watch like modern Star Wars content with an understanding of very bleak happenings in the real world, like technologically, like big data, mass surveillance, I'm finding it difficult that they don't have that in Star Wars. And I understand part of the constraint is like I don't think the writers of the original series understood, you know, where these things would go back in the day. And it's like, oh, do we want to like make the Empire way more powerful than it was then? And like, you know, how do we handle that? But it's like, man, like if I were a totalitarian dictator, and if you look at the totalitarian governments today, like mass surveillance and I don't know, keeping track of where people are living is just a very high priority. And other people have written about this. I actually found a blog on like a privacy website that's like, you know, if they had this, you know, a search of records would have told you where Luke Skywalker was living, and simple analysis would have been like, oh, this is Leia and Luke are Vader's kids. And it's like, when you look at China, it's like the artificial intelligence, they're using that and developing it to identify members of ethnic minorities. And it's like terrifying. But I don't, it's like, how long should Star Wars totally steer clear of that? Because, you know, some of the charm of Star Wars is you can speak to the issues of your own day, even if you're like operating in this this separate universe. And it's like, I don't know. This series sort of highlighted that for me, because I was like, I feel like in like a high-tech empire, they would have prioritized this more.
Well, I mean, first of all, the fact that the stormtroopers don't recognize Obi-Wan.
Right, right.
When he should be on every most wanted list, you know, in perpetuity, but particularly at that moment. Also, he walks around dressed as a Jedi. Like, I I don't think anybody yet has offered like a contrary explanation a reasonable explanation for that. Something to debunk the criticism that is ridiculous. Like, I don't know that anybody has said, because you can't make the claim that it's just a normal person outfit, because we don't see anybody else dressed that way. And of course, the reason for that is they want us to visually recognize like Jedi in Jedi robes. Like, there's a reason that fake Jedi dude also dresses like that. That's a Jedi outfit. Like, It's not like labeled Jedi. It's not like he wears a badge that says Jedi, but there's a reason that he doesn't happen to stumble across any random person dressed in exactly that same way. It's because that's a specific type of dress. And the fact that they didn't, like, they weren't scanning for that particular outfit, as you said, Haley, the technology exists in the real world to do that. I will say this, though. I think it's less about wanting to avoid direct political commentary or direct social commentary, and more that, like, let's get down to brass tacks, folks. None of these stories could happen if the Empire actually used, like, Clearview AI or, like, any of these, like, real technologies. Like, it would be over in a heartbeat. Like, not, you wouldn't have people evading the totalitarian state if it used the technology that real totalitarian states use.
But then you get to do really cool cyberpunk storylines where they are trying to evade these things. And to be clear, I wasn't insinuating that it was, like, a political decision not to write about this. Although, like, there is the case for that with Disney.
Yes.
My understanding of it is we've known what the Empire is and what it can do for so long. Like, to introduce, like, all-powerful tools like this would just throw, like, a lot of wrench. Sort of like the mech shop on Tatooine, and you can revive anyone. I don't know. I would like to see maybe in future Star Wars content to deal with that, because I don't, like, human nature being what it is, I don't think you can have interstellar travel and, like, a galaxy-wide spanning empire without, you know, power-hungry people wanting to develop those kinds of tools.
Yeah, I mean, once we go down that road, though, we have to acknowledge that he couldn't be named Ben Kenobi and rename himself Ben Kenobi and have Luke freaking Skywalker living with Anakin's aunt or stepbrother and sister-in-law. Like, that, I mean, at a certain point, they just can't, for the reason that Eric outlined, I think. But I do agree with you. I think it does, in today's era, beggar belief that we have R2-D2, this extremely intelligent droid, but we don't have, you know, facial recognition technology. But it is what it is.
And you know, maybe we do. I mean, maybe it does exist, and it's just a question of when they need to tell a story where the Empire very quickly identifies somebody based on their face, they will tell that story. Like,
I mean, even if they wrote it out during, like, one of the cartoon series, like, and I know you have, like, abuses of power, but maybe the people of the Star Wars galaxy feel so strongly about privacy rights that, like, this is the one thing that you can't touch. Like, you can't install, I don't know, universal surveillance cameras. But I would like to see how that debate played out, and I don't know, at least have a reason that it feels like we're watching some medieval thing, even though you have interstellar travel.
Yeah, somehow I think the Empire wouldn't respect, like, the privacy Bill of Rights. I feel like that. I feel like they have surveillance technology, and it's just, again, when a story requires the Empire to quickly and easily find somebody, they will show us them using that technology. But so far, most of the stories they want to tell involve being able to avoid that kind of thing, because that's game over pretty quickly in most cases. So as we kind of close out here, I do want to talk about Leia just a little bit. I thought that the second half of the series continued to develop her character in really interesting and fun ways. I liked seeing her step into the role that we know Carrie Fisher will later inhabit. She has these scenes in, I think it's the fourth episode, when she's been captured, and she really kind of really defies not only Reva, but also the stormtroopers. You know, she speaks to them with this sense of authority. You know, she has this scene with Obi-Wan where he gives her the holster and he says, like, I'm not going to give you a gun, but, like, you're not going to be 10 years old forever. Eventually, you're going to have to step into this conflict in a more direct way. And it's this nice moment of acknowledging that her future is not going to be bright and innocent. It is going to be full of a lot of darkness, unfortunately. And she continues to have this great relationship with him. You know, she gives him Lola to sort of protect him. And I don't know, I just thought, what did you think about how we saw Leia in these three episodes? I thought they continued to really pay off that relationship with Obi-Wan very well and continue to sort of show her growth towards A New Hope.
So as listeners know, my biggest criterion for this show was, does it justify its existence? And while I enjoyed the Obi-Wan and Vader stuff, and as Eric said, if they absolutely had to do it, it was done pretty well. For me, what really justified the existence of this show was having us see young Leia and having her established as just as important as Luke, and establishing her character as a child, establishing that relationship with Obi-Wan, having her be a real protagonist, and given the kind of depth that she deserves in her background, so that she's not just some random princess showing up, but that she has this real history and has been influenced by where she was raised and by who raised her. And so I was just thrilled to see the establishment of Leia as that kind of character. And then the second thing that is related that the show did that justified its existence to me was showing that Breha and Bail to Leia and Owen and Beru to Luke were just as important parental figures and guiding their children to becoming the heroes that we see in the original trilogy. I think that was really important to have that established, particularly since adoptive parents are often given a real short shrift in media or not seen as real parents, but to establish that these respective couples raised these kids as their own, and that those kids were who they were just as much because of those adoptive parents, I think was really cool. So, yes, loved that.
How about when Obi-Wan is talking about how Leia became the person that she is and all the qualities that she got from each of her parents, and they play Carrie Fisher's Leia theme for just a moment? How about that? How nice was that?
I did cry.
She also says, you know, she tells her parents, look, I will start on this journey that you've imagined for me, but I'm going to do it my way. I'm not just going to join the Senate and be any old senator. I'm going to shake things up. And I like that Bail is kind of with her on that. It's a continuation of him honoring her mischievous, rebellious instincts in a way that her mother really can't. She doesn't have the space to do that. He's able to be that figure for her of saying, yeah, I'll go with you on that journey and I will help you make this the job that you think it needs to be. So I liked that moment as well. And I definitely agree with you that this show really honors adoptive parents as very much real parents in every sense of that word, because that's what these people were to these kids. So I thought that was wonderful. So, you know, we're coming to the end. We obviously have so much more that we could say about these episodes, but let's do a kind of a rapid fire about the other things. I mean, we've got, obviously, in our show notes, we have quite a number of other things that we wanted to mention. Let's do an alternating rapid fire of other observations that we had in one sentence or less about these episodes. I'll start. Ian McDiarmid as Emperor Palpatine cameo at the very end. Loved seeing that and his suspicion of Vader and whether his focus was on the right things. Really happy to see Ian McDiarmid again.
I will go next. Beru was so unexpectedly cool when she pulled out that rifle and was like, yeah, let's throw down with this Inquisitor. Loved that. Loved to see more of her. In a perfect world, we would get a Beru White Sun Lars prequel series.
I want to see more of the giant space desert lizard that Obi-Wan was mining at the beginning. If we're just going around saying what we really liked, that may have been my favorite part of the show. I thought it was really fun.
That checks out.
I wanted to eat it.
You know, that checks out. Qui-Gon. Really curious to know what he meant by Obi-Wan not being ready earlier. I'm curious to know what exactly changed there. Was it the duel with Vader? But yeah, Qui-Gon cameo. We kind of all expected it, and there it was. Liam Neeson back in Star Wars.
Natalie Holt, who did the music for Loki, did most of the music for the Obi-Wan show, and the score, much like the score for the Loki TV show, was just great, filled with bangers. Love it.
So I'm glad the Grand Inquisitor lived, as they made it pretty clear that he would once people started to voice concerns about that. Obviously, they knew what they were doing. I said I would give them the benefit of the doubt, and they did the right thing. But man, they need to stop using the excuse that somebody is still alive because they just hate so strong. Really, really bothered by that.
I will, since Haley mentioned it, I just do want to bring up that space lizard fish and how it really did look yummy. Like, it looked like sashimi. And I think that was... Because now you got me thinking about it.
If I were Obi-Wan, I would have been cutting myself a slice of that too. Not just for the little creature that he rode around on.
Speaking of dead things, there were some Easter eggs in the tomb underneath Fortress Inquisitorius. And I think we've got to say, shout out to a real one, RIP Terra Sanube. Was not expecting that. Kind of a great, like, deep pull for them to use as the cameo there. But man, Terra Sanube, that gives me some feels.
Ooh, I had another one that was just totally random. As you know, I do love pointing out when actors in Star Wars shows were in other things. And one of the background characters in the last couple of episodes, one of the rebel pilots, was played by Maya Erskine from Pen 15. So that was fun.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Did we discuss the hello there?
No, we didn't.
That was going to be my last comment. But yes, the hello there, obviously honoring the most memeable Obi-Wan line, but also not just throwing it in as an Easter egg, you know, actually putting it in a place where it mattered, where it had resonance, where he's actually meeting Luke.
Perfectly placed, perfectly timed, perfectly delivered.
One more from me. Pretty stupid that Vader's Star Destroyer could not take on both the escape pod and the ship with all the refugee people on it.
Right. Don't they have little TIE fighters in there that they could have deployed?
Well, they also have just more than one gun. So it's like, that part to me, like, did not, like, I don't know. People, you'd think that Disney would have learned its lesson from The Last Jedi and the idea that, like, for story reasons, the ship can't do the thing that the ship very obviously can do, and we need to come up with some silly explanation for why it can't do it. Here, there wasn't even an explanation. It was just like, yeah, we don't really feel like shooting at both of them at the same time. We can't go faster. Sorry. So that was pretty silly.
The last thing I will say was how funny it was that pretty much everyone is like to Vader, like, dude, you need to chill out about Obi-Wan. Like, you really need to calm down. It's getting weird, bro.
Like, it's starting to interfere with your work. I'm gonna recommend that you see somebody about this.
Yeah. Like, the way, the look that the Grand Inquisitor gives Vader when Vader is like, let's go after Obi-Wan, and Grand Inquisitor just gives him this look like, okay, dude, you're the boss, but
I think we've kind of all been there, though, when our boss has been like, all right, this is what we're doing, and we're just kind of like, that doesn't seem right to me, but you're in charge, so here we go. Also, RIP Wade and RIP Tala. Shout out to two real ones there. Wade has become something of a meme on Star Wars subreddit, so just wanted to honor Wade and his T-47. I think we
Why
need.
Why did they name him Wade?
Don't you think that they've established with Rogue One that they're willing to do prequels for the littlest things, and there should be a Wade prequel?
Yes.
I mean, it was a very touching. Like, it seemed like they were close to each other, Wade and the woman who was upset about Wade.
Played by Maya Erskine from Pen 15.
Oh, yes. There should be a prequel where they're, like, in love. I don't know if you guys can tell if based on the fact that I mention it every episode, but I'm very much here for more romance in Star Wars. Any way to get that into Star Wars a little more would be nice.
The only thought that I had when his ship was destroyed is, man, what a wage to go. Sorry. I'm sorry. It was sitting right there.
Boo.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for our episode on the second half of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hofftakes@gmail.com or find us on Twitter. We're on Twitter as hofftakes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Birdinator. Speaking of Haley, she made our wonderful logo and banner art. I edited this episode, and I also put together our music. And as always, we want to point out that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. If you'd like to listen to past episodes, you can find those, a complete archive of them, in fact, on our website, hofftakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hot Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. All right, we'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.